sports magazines, or manuals on the latest video games. This course production and understanding are most readily developed in areas of high interest. Language output is an especially elusive undertaking for some, and for that reason I would like to give it some further emphasis. There was a time in our schools when every child was required on a regular basis to take a course called rhetoric. In contemporary culture, not as much attention is paid to oral language production, the ability to encode ideas into clear, cogent, and colorful semantics, syntax, and discourse. Verbal eloquence and fluency are dramatically less evident in many classrooms as a result. Effective oral language serves an abundance of purposes. For one thing, it correlates highly with writing skill. Quite understandably, if you don't talk too good, it might be you don't write too good neither. Language production serves as a lubricant for memory. As pointed out in the previous chapter, verbal elaboration makes it easier to consolidate information and skill in long-term memory. We also make use of language as an implement for creative expression, as a wrench for tightening our grasp of concepts, and as an elixir for winning and keeping friends. Expressive language plays a less obvious but powerful role in regulating behavior. Words and sentences can be peacemakers and problem solvers within a social milieu. We adjust our feelings and actions by talking to ourselves. Internal voices, normal ones, not hallucinations, enable people to self-coach, to verbalize internally as they consider the likely consequences of various actions they are contemplating. They are also able to talk through, buffer, and modify their inner feelings. When individuals lack expressive language ability, they may be susceptible to the development of aggressive behaviors and also depression or excessive anxiety. I participated in several research studies involving early adolescent juvenile delinquents. In these investigations, we sought to uncover specific neurodevelopmental dysfunctions that were common among these kids. We were struck by how many teenagers in serious trouble with the law had signs of expressive language dysfunction as one of the risk factors that led to their downward spiral. In fact, it turns out that at two ages in particular, namely preschool and late adolescence, language production problems are strongly associated with acting out, aggressive, and sometimes downright antisocial behaviors. So the stakes are sky high when it comes to expressive language capacities. Now here's the irony. We have described this crucial area of brain function. Even subtle weaknesses can have onerous repercussions. Yet it can be perilously tricky to uncover an expressive language dysfunction in a student. In many cases, literate expressive language dysfunction is disguised under fairly good conversational skills. That is, the nice and fluent automatic English described earlier. Additionally, the tests used by clinicians to diagnose language dysfunctions are weak at uncovering subtle expressive language problems, particularly in older kids. To make matters worse, the tests that are used often are culturally biased and hard to interpret. So given the importance of expressive language and the need to diagnose kids who are having difficulties with it, how do we find out who is an expressive linguist and who is at an expressive disadvantage? There is only one way. We need to attune regular classroom teachers and parents to listen carefully to a child to determine whether there might be a breakdown in literate language production. Classroom teachers have the special advantage of having fellow students with whom to compare the student they are observing. Kids with expressive language problems come up against communication barriers at home and in school. They need plenty of practice. I have told many of them over the years that they need to build up their language muscles. They should be encouraged to tell a lot of stories and describe experiences, even if this is hard for them. In school, they need opportunities to make oral presentations, especially on topics that excite them. In severe cases, with significant word-finding, articulation, or sentence-building weaknesses, students can benefit from the services of a trained language specialist in school or in the community. Making arrangements are spatial and sequential ordering systems. Is there a member of your family who is late for everything, who can never seem to handle a deadline or due date, and who gets confused when given more than two things in a row to accomplish? If so, that person may have trouble finding and creating order in the vast world of sequences, of information that has to be thought about or acted upon in a particular order. Do you live or work with someone who has a hopelessly misguided sense of direction? A person who is hesitant about the distinction between left and right, and who loses most worldly possessions most of the time? If so, that sometimes disoriented individual may be having trouble finding and creating order in the world of space, that hazy montage of dimensions and relationships beyond the borders of our bodies. Now we're going to look at two neurodevelopmental systems that help children set up and orient their learning, their thinking, their remembering, and their output, either in a usable sequence or in a cohesive spatial pattern. Sequential and spatial ordering help our children learn on distinct levels that range from the most rudimentary sorting out of simple instructions to the most intricate ways of learning and performing. On that most basic level, a student has to interpret or perceive a spatial array, such as the shape of a country on a map, or sequential pattern, such as the order of beats in a musical rhythm, perhaps storing these key perceptions for later use. On the creating level, there are times when the student will need to manufacture his own sequences, such as while creating a melody on the piano, or spatial products, such as while shaping a ceramic pitcher. Often he will be expected to be well organized with time, getting places promptly, and with space, remembering where he left his keys, and to be able to reason, conceptualize, and problem solve using sequences, by thinking through a math problem in a logical order, or mental imagery, picturing electricity flowing through a wire. Your child may be strong or weak at any or all of these levels in sequential or spatial ordering systems, or in both systems, and you may find that one or both of his parents may also struggle with time or space, or perhaps a little of each. These strengths and weaknesses are in plain view in school and at home. I will be describing the effects of strength and weakness in these ordering systems regarding school performance, as well as some of the other disturbing and too often misunderstood setbacks that occur when an unsuspecting kid encounters difficulty with respect to order. First, we'll examine sequential ordering, then spatial ordering. Why is it that my Carol seems to do everything the hard way? And how come she does most things in the wrong order? Parents may be perplexed by the realization that their child's life is somehow out of order. From getting herself dressed to reciting the alphabet, she meets havoc throughout the day, bewildered by teachers' rapid volleys of multi-step directions and expectations for efficient sequential output. She may find it hard to organize her thoughts to present them orally in coherent steps. She most likely feels defective and markedly inferior to her peers. Here's a typical brief biography of such a needlessly suffering ego. Joanne's parents arrived at the indisputable conclusion that this gusher of pure charm didn't know the meaning of the word time. When I first saw Joanne in my office, she was 11, a very anxious and withdrawn student from northern New Jersey. She was always out of time, and never known to be on time or even close to functioning in step with time. Interestingly, and not at all unusual, her father had a similar lack of orientation and time. Joanne's mother said the two of them made her tear out her hair when the family needed to go someplace. Dad and daughter were never in a state of readiness. In fact, I'm pretty sure the problem caused Joanne's father, a furniture designer, to lose two jobs and to be passed over for promotion once. He confessed that he did everything at the last minute and often missed important deadlines. He had a reputation for being unreliable at work, even though the drawings he ultimately produced were quite good. Too bad this man never knew he had a lifelong sequencing problem. That is, until we discussed Joanne's glitches. He could have worked on them and saved himself a lot of agony. That happens all too often in my office. I discuss a child's dysfunctions, and one or both parents recognize themselves in what I'm saying. Reliably late for all dates and appointments, to this day Joanne remains unsure about the order of the months of the year and often gets mixed up when given three or four things in a row to do in school or at home. As a preschooler and well into elementary school, Joanne had trouble reckoning with the order of days of the week and sequences of steps in various math procedures. This girl was noticeably late in learning to tell time and is still hesitant in doing so. Her digital watch has been a lifesaver. Throughout elementary school, Joanne was told over and over again that she wasn't really trying. She was made to feel that her tardiness and disorganization were her fault, that she had a bad attitude. On frequent occasions, she told her mother that she didn't much like herself. In kindergarten and first grade, Joanne became disoriented when sentences contained temporal prepositions, such as before and after. For instance, she once told her dad, "I hope you get home late tonight so we can play together outside before it gets dark." Joanne has always excelled in science. She currently loves her physics class and has gotten A's in all her science courses. She wants to be either a geophysicist or an anthropologist. She is universally popular. But in school, Joanne struggles with anything requiring sequences, a fact no one has observed. In third grade and fifth grade, she was evaluated for possible learning disabilities, but because there was no significant difference between her IQ and her achievement test scores, she was deemed ineligible for any services and determined not to be learning disabled. But no one ever said what she was. The way we test for learning disabilities is especially irrational, since there has never been much agreement regarding what learning disability is. This kind of nonsense goes on all the time, as all sorts of invalid formulas are used to determine who has a genuine right to be helped and who does not. Joanne was victimized by her school's special formula. Her parents were totally confused. After all, if she's not LD, then she must be stupid or hopelessly lazy. What else is there? I met Joanne shortly after her second school evaluation, after which her mother declared, "Nobody understands this girl. I know there's something going on here, and it's being dreadfully overlooked." Our team tested Joanne. From her history, I suspected she might be struggling with sequencing. This was soon confirmed. When I showed Joanne a series of different shapes and pointed to each of these in a particular order, she was unable to remember and recreate the order. She could only retain a sequence of three objects, but she should have been able to remember five or six. She also had trouble repeating numbers in the correct order. By the time we were nearly finished with our various sequential ordering tasks, I could see tears welling up in Joanne's eyes. It's amazing how often a child's sad moods and feelings come forth and become amplified when confronting a specific area of weakness. So out of compassion, I promptly quit this pursuit and switched to something she could do well. Joanne bounced back. Once we pinpointed Joanne's troubles with sequential ordering, we were able to make recommendations. The first was to help her understand the nature of her sequencing trouble. Ann Hobgood, our educational diagnostician, met with Joanne several times and talked to her over the telephone regularly. Joanne was encouraged to be especially alert in the presence of sequences, to visualize when people were talking to her in sequences, and to whisper under her breath. She was also taught to make flow diagrams to help her think about different sequential processes in math and science. Because of her past lack of progress, Joanne was taken out of school and her mother homeschooled her for 2 years, during which time she made dramatic gains in her overall academic performance, her sequencing strategies, and her organizational practices. Back in a regular school program in eighth grade, she continued to thrive academically. Now, nearly 17, Joanne has learned to apply computer graphics effectively. She creates flowcharts, timelines, and other such diagrammatic representations to help her learn and remember processes or events that take place in a specific serial order. Her parents, after coming to understand the nature of their daughter's neurodevelopmental dysfunction, encouraged her to exploit her keen spatial abilities to compensate for her unreliable sequencing. Joanne made that discovery herself. After years of struggling at the bottom of her class, Joanne's stock is starting to rise. Much of this acceleration resulted when one perceptive teacher finally sat down and reviewed with Joanne the fact that she had all the abilities she needed to succeed in life, but that she was being hampered by problems with sequential ordering. Joanne felt redeemed. Her motivation was restored, and she was able to make much better use of her admirable assets. Sequential perception. A 4 or 5-year-old needs to perceive that Tuesday predictably precedes Wednesday, every week without fail. And summer occurs before autumn, year after year. A student's mind must appreciate such stable internal order within all manner of sequences. Early on, when exposed to the letters of the alphabet, does this kindergartner really and truly see their order? How deep an impression in consciousness is made by the order of the 12 months of the year? When a teacher is describing the procedure for accomplishing long division, does a student thoroughly interpret the order of steps needed to arrive at the correct answer? Each of these questions would have been answered not that much in Joanne's case, as it would be for so many others like her. Some students are astute, highly sensitive detectors of serial order, while others, like her, are comparatively oblivious. Early on, parents may wonder why the months of the year were never fully mastered by their kid. Why that same son or daughter may have had difficulty learning letters of the alphabet in the correct order, as well as why he or she has problems with everyday sequencing hurdles, such as combination locks, telephone numbers, and the interpretation of multi-step commands or instructions. When they suspect a possible dysfunction, parents can teach their child rhymes for the sequences, make use of comic strip stories to combine sequencing with visual imagery, and even have the child try a musical instrument that stresses serial order without being too oppressively sequentially complex. Trombones, percussion, double basses, and drums are relatively user-friendly candidates. Rhythmic dance might also be helpful in reinforcing sequential ordering. Sequential memory. Remembering how to tie your shoelaces, or later on your necktie, requires the ability to consolidate in memory and later retrieve motor sequences. The recall of birthdays, the remembering of a recipe for apricot mousse, and the recall of a rather long joke also enlist the ability to remember things in the right order. 4 different forms of sequential memory challenge students in school. The first calls for briefly holding a sequence in short-term memory, while the other 3 involve more or less permanent storage in long-term memory. The first 2 of these entail procedural memory, as introduced earlier. The first, motor procedural memory, consists of your ability to file away and later recall the steps for accomplishing recurring tasks in and out of school. It includes the formulas for tying your shoelaces, using cursive writing, remembering how to serve in tennis, and recalling the steps needed to do the Wabash cannonball at a square dance. All of these examples constitute motor procedural memory because they are all primarily muscular activities adhering to a sequential blueprint. Non-motor procedural memory is our second form of sequential long-term storage. Non-motor procedural memory includes a vast array of processes that do not primarily involve muscular output, yet still represent ways of doing things. The potentially puzzling procedure for reducing a fraction, the daily routines of a classroom, as well as the steps involved in reporting the results of a science experiment, are kept on file for quick access in non-motor procedural memory. Factual sequences are the third component in long-term sequential memory. Included here are some items I have already mentioned, including the days of the week, the months of the year, alphabetical order, telephone numbers, and many mathematics facts. It is noteworthy that so many children who have trouble filing factual sequences have a hard time remembering the multiplication tables, There's a convincing correlation between the ability to deposit and recall this kind of mathematical information and the storing of other factual sequences. So often, when parents find that a child can't seem to learn math facts, the neurodevelopmental culprit seems to reside in sequential memory. Affected kids need extra drill and also benefit from the various tricks of the trade that many math teachers know that serve to make multiplication facts more logical and less dependent on rote recall. Check with your local math guru for advice. Now let's explore sequential output. Kids with sequential output problems are likely to leak the punchline when they tell a joke. Or else, in relating a personal experience, they are apt to communicate the chain of events chaotically out of order. Many forms of output have to be arranged in a logical sequence. Students with a neurodevelopmental dysfunction thwarting sequential output become frustrated in arranging things sequentially or performing tasks in the best order. As the parent of a first grader, you might witness your child getting dressed in the morning and find that there is absolutely no rationale for the order in which she puts on her clothing. First she puts on a sock, then an undershirt, followed swiftly by another sock, and next some other randomly plucked fragment of attire. This dearth of sequential ordering might be an early warning signal in a child destined for academic sequencing chaos. Sequential organization, time management. Being organized in time rallies the ability to allocate time, to estimate time, and to be aware of the passage of time. It enables your child to gauge when he is running ahead or running behind, and it helps him meet deadlines and cope with transitions, such as leaving home to go to a movie. A modicum of time management savvy is needed for a student to realize that if he has a book report due on Tuesday, there exist some very undeniable implications regarding when he needs to read the book. For some students, the planning and plotting of time makes no sense. They are like stowaways on a timeless raft. These perpetual laggards and drifters have trouble thinking about time, using time efficiently, and organizing themselves within any kind of time frame. The meeting of deadlines consequently seems like an arbitrary imposition, and they are loath to estimate how long it will take them to accomplish something, which in turn makes it hard to allocate the time to do whatever it is that needs doing. Such seemingly lackadaisical behavior can infuriate a non-understanding parent or a demanding, compulsive teacher, especially when these supervisory adults are paragons of punctuality themselves. These kids need a lot of help from their parents in planning a schedule for the week ahead, making explicit plans for meeting deadlines, deciding what will get done when. It's helpful for them to keep lists of things that need to be accomplished during the day and evening, checking off each as it is achieved. Higher sequential thinking. Many aptitude tests include items like read the following list of numbers and decide what number comes next. 2, 6, 18, 54. These activities require some high-potency sequential thought processes. The ultimate in sequential ordering is performed on this stratospheric plane, which takes in the ability to make good use of deductive and inductive logic and to reason and problem-solve in a systematic sequential manner. Well-worked-out geometric proofs are likely to be among the most dazzling exhibitions of higher-order sequential thinking, as they stress steps in the best order to prove a point. Higher sequential thinking fosters step wisdom, which is simply the much-needed realization that in order to accomplish anything substantial or complex, the activity must be broken down into a series of incremental, bite-sized, manageable sequential steps. Some students are devoid of any awareness of the virtues and advantages of step wisdom. These children are overwhelmed because they lack a sense of how to break down a task into a series of achievable sequential stages. If you don't know what to do first, second, and third, how do you begin? The solution is straightforward. Parents have to help the student get started and also get him to talk through the different steps he intends to go through to get the job done. Now it's time to take a look at spatial ordering. Getting oriented and organized in space is yet another challenge faced by growing minds. Knowing left from right, working within the margins on a page, picturing characters while reading, and remembering where you put down the other sock are formidable developmental hurdles that are effortlessly managed by some kids, but not others. Alvin is an example of a kid who was always out of space, if not rather spacey. Alvin, at age 6, was stressed out in first grade. This rather withdrawn and passive child, the tallest and stockiest kid in his class, had problems telling left from right, tying his shoelaces, and copying from the board. To make matters worse, he kept losing things. He was on a perpetual pencil search. The interior of his desk was a crumpled paper haven, with loose crayons, rubber bands, and heaps of other refuse. At home, Alvin's parents complained that he didn't know where to put or find anything. When getting dressed, he regularly put shirts and underwear on backward. Alvin could be a friendly guy at times, despite his passivity, but his interactions with other children were limited by a lack of confidence in his ability to keep up in sports. Alvin could neither catch a ball nor throw a ball, although he was good at swimming and running. Any athletic pursuit that required precise spatial judgment eluded him. This boy had a delightfully crazy fantasy life and adored imaginary play. He made liberal use of his impressive vocabulary and sustained a strong interest in outer space exploration. He was reading at a third grade level, displaying good spelling skills, and writing fanciful stories and complete sentences. On the other hand, Alvin was failing to assimilate key concepts in arithmetic that are best grasped through imagery. He couldn't quite picture what was happening when a child in a word problem gave away 3 of his 6 pieces of chocolate. This child was succeeding in life in all areas except those that demanded spatial ordering. Spatial ordering contrasts with sequential ordering. In the latter, as we have seen, information is or becomes coded in a particular serial order, and that serial order dictates much of the meaning, storage, format, and application of that information. In spatial ordering, very different arrangements prevail. Data arrive or depart from the brain simultaneously, or nearly so, as a whole, or in configuration. Thus, a painting by Mondrian, the shape of a flask, and the spiraling petals of a flower all comprise simultaneous arrays of data. Our minds are expected to deal with the contained stimuli and their interrelationships virtually all at once. If for some reason we decide only to process one internal feature at a time, it will not be helpful in appreciating the overall pattern. Spatial perception. How many rabbits are in this picture? Which of these figures has a right angle in it? Touch your left shoulder with your right hand. All these demands trigger our perceptions of objects in space. The various features and relationships within a display of simultaneous information together represent its perceptual content. Highly specific features come together to form a complete image or a pattern. They include such vivid variables as the relative sizes and locations of component parts, an awareness of what's in the foreground and what's in the background, three-dimensionality, symmetry versus asymmetry, and left versus right. Another feature of spatial perception is known as whole-part relationship. What goes with what? How does the whole relate to its constituent pieces? So in gazing meaningfully at a portrait or scanning a bus map, one surveys its parts and their relative positions, almost at the same time discerning which of the parts connect through various linkages with other points in space. Interestingly, there are some young children who become confused by these whole part determinations. They seem to have a weak sense of such crucial relationships. As a result, when they write, there may be as much space between letters as there is between words. They are bewildered by what goes with what within a spatial package. There are many children and adults with deficiencies of spatial perception who nonetheless do extremely well in school and in their careers. Being great at spatial perception seems not to be a graduation requirement. So we may elect to do nothing about a shortcoming in this neurodevelopmental function. After all, we don't need to fix everything. Spatial memory. It's necessary to store some important spatial information in memory. Often, this form of long-term memory is considered to be visual memory because so much of what we retain from spatial experience passes initially through the visual pathways in our brains. However, we also harvest abundant spatial cues with our probing fingers and by moving our bodies through all sorts of spatial pathways. You put your hand in your pocket and discover a paperclip. You can identify it without removing it because touch sensation has its own spatial memory facility. Spatial data is a multisensory venture. No one pathway monopolizes it. Nevertheless, it is fair to say that in school, the eyes have it. Visual memory predominates in telling a Pablo Picasso from a Norman Rockwell, in remembering the difference between a flask and a beaker, in recalling how a small G and a small Q differ, and in knowing a semicolon every time you spot one. A child with spatial memory problems may find it hard to remember the appearance of a parallelogram, the chemical symbol for tin, or the shape of a cumulus cloud. While these learning tasks will not be insurmountable educational barriers, they have the potential to vex a child's education. Parents and teachers should encourage their kids with leaky spatial memory to transfer as much visual learning as possible to verbal memory. Spatial output. Arranging flower stems in a vase, straightening pictures on a wall, and conquering a 1,500-piece jigsaw puzzle may not be pass keys to stellar success in our society, but they do provide gratification and a nice way to feel effective. Spatial output may allow a striving child to take credit for things that are useful and or attractive. Many creative arts, such as sculpture, painting, and interior design, represent worthy conquests over space. Strong spatial output teams up with creativity and excellent motor ability to generate oil portraits or fantastic Lego creations. Kids like Alvin fall flat on their face when it comes to making use of any spatial plan or connecting spatial intentions with various forms of motor output. A parent or teacher may feel a sense of annoyance at a kid who seems to do such shoddy work. Spatial incompetence may come across as a lackadaisical attitude. Such a child may feel ashamed and believe he is totally inept. He may struggle to divert classmates from seeing his work, especially in the early grades. Over time, such conspicuous challenges as hammering a nail in straight, inserting a key into a lock right side up, operating a pair of scissors, drawing a straight line, and penciling a realistic sketch damage the self-esteem of a child with sloppy spatial output. Parents need to reassure a child like Alvin that his spatial defeats are not a cause for great worry in the long run, that many of the world's most successful adults have had trouble succeeding in the worlds of arts and crafts and manual repair. It is especially important to emphasize the strengths of such a kid, since his dearth of spatial mastery is so visible to the world at large that it may obscure less obvious abilities such as creativity, strong problem solving, or excellent receptive language. It is also possible to make use of technology to allow a child to savor the satisfaction that comes with spatial accomplishment. Computer graphics are likely to do the trick. Teachers should encourage their widespread use among those with spatial output impairments. Using such graphics, these students derive some pleasure from producing attractive imagery and layouts. Spatial organization, material management. Does your child keep losing gloves, pens, sweaters, homework assignments, and lunch money? Does he forget to take the field trip permission slip to school? Are all the tattered pages falling out of his bulging loose-leaf notebook? Does he have trouble finding a place to write his book report because of the heaps of socks and underwear occupying his desktop? Does he forget to remove one of his socks when he takes a bath? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then your son or daughter may be suffering from a material management dysfunction, a chronic condition that at once borders on the ludicrous, at the same time that it incites flagrant bouts of anguish and anger on the part of well-meaning parents. Just as time management is the organizational byproduct of sequential ordering, material management helps your child organize her physical world. Parents can help a child organize a home office with labeled drawers, shelves, and boxes. Notebooks can undergo periodic refurbishment under parental guidance. Sometimes parents need to take over entirely the chore of keeping a kid's workspace neat so he can acquire a taste for material order. This tactic may or may not work. Mothers and fathers, at the very least, can take solace in the fact that many an absent-minded professor has a disastrous office and an endless paper trail. Higher spatial thinking. Determining why your skateboard or bicycle isn't working right demands high-level spatial problem solving. You look things over and try to figure out where the mechanical glitch may be and what you need to do about it. Understanding how the airflow created by a jet plane affects its altitude and forward thrust takes higher spatial thinking. Observe your child problem-solve and strategize like a 5-star general overseeing the field of battle as he conquers the latest esoteric computer game. You will have encountered scintillating glimmers of higher spatial thinking, a set of mind operations that enables kids to think about and move around within their mind's impressively complicated images and spatial relationships. I've mentioned how language-loaded school tends to be. Higher spatial thinking offers some relief from the verbal aches and pains of the standard curriculum. It lets students work around, back up, or minimize the use of words and sentences in understanding. Good use of mental imagery relieves the need to put every single idea or skill you learn in school into words and sentences. And there are subjects in which higher spatial thinking is generously rewarded. Certain scientific mechanisms and mathematical concepts, such as place value, equations, and resistance in a wire, are optimally thought about without the exclusive use of language, simply by shifting into the higher spatial thinking gear. It would be hard and mostly unnecessary to concoct vigorous interventions to help kids improve their higher spatial thinking. Instead, they should be aware of this weakness and seek verbal and/or sequential or even hands-on ways of problem-solving and conceptualization. Our motor system. Returning a ping-pong serve, threading a needle, making a graph, and playing scales on a fife all have in common the need for extensive highways of branching nerve cells that communicate with diverse groups of muscles situated throughout our bodies. These intricate motor pathways enable us to perform pursuits that range from surfboarding to keyboarding. During the school years, successful motor function contributes generously to a child's self-esteem while opening doors to a range of recreational activities and opportunities to be productive with schoolwork. Motor activity fosters physical conditioning and permits the acquisition of a wide repertoire of self-help skills, ranging from clipping fingernails without bloodletting to repairing a bicycle chain to sewing a hem. At its best, it can also encourage collaboration, planning, self-monitoring, and high moral standards, that is, good sportsmanship. Efficient motor output also helps accomplish some important academic skills. Most obviously, some of the most complex muscular manipulations are demanded for writing. There are countless students with good ideas whose fingers just can't keep pace with their thinking, as a result of which, they come to despise and avoid writing. Well-coordinated muscular output also works its wonders in some less obvious ways. When operating well, motor actions reinforce memory and learning. Direct hands-on experience, manipulating materials in a science experiment, or engaging in athletic pursuits can actually improve various neurodevelopmental functions, such as active working memory and problem solving. Clearly, a student engineering a crucial basketball play and responding to the hard-to-anticipate moves of other players is exercising not only his muscles, but also some problem-solving and reasoning faculties. Motor engagements enable kids to learn by doing. This can be one of the most meaningful ways of learning. 5 distinct forms of motor function dominate work and play and together comprise the major components of the motor system. These include gross motor function, fine motor function, graphomotor function, musical motor function, and oromotor function. Gross motor function involves the activity of large muscles, making possible all the actions needed to serve a tennis ball, engage in a strenuous workout, pedal a tricycle, or toss a bale of hay. Small muscles, principally those in our hands and fingers, dedicate themselves to fine motor function, manual dexterity. The nearly synonymous term eye-hand coordination reminds us that the purposeful movements of our fingers need visual supervision. Your work's cut out for you if you try trimming your toenails, pounding in a nail, or creating origami figures with your eyes closed. Fine motor and graphomotor function are quite different. Graphomotor function is the highly specialized motor output used in writing. Many students boast superb fine motor abilities and unacceptable graphomotor function. Musical motor output has to be one of the more obscure brain operations. A wide range of muscular responses and sensory inputs achieve their special harmonies. Playing the harp, square dancing, appreciating and mimicking rock rhythms all draw upon an individual's musical motor coordination, yielding varying degrees of triumph or despair. Oromotor function is yet another manifestation of controlled muscular activity. Our cheeks are stuffed with some of our busiest muscle groups, which carry out the incompatible roles of pulverizing food and generating speech. Obviously, such activity plays a critical role across the gamut of oral communication, from complaining to yodeling. Oromotor fluency facilitates participation in class discussions. Interestingly, many of the same kids who have trouble with oromotor function experience difficulty with graphomotor function. In fact, a great many preschoolers who receive language therapy for speech articulation end up having writing difficulty in the early grades in school. In all likelihood, this is because both oromotor and graphomotor function involve rapid motor sequencing. Everyday eye-hand coordination activities, such as connecting the dots in a puzzle and buttoning a blouse, are not executed with nearly the speed and complicated sequential flow that drives written output and talking. Gross motor function. I don't think anyone has ever brought a child to see me just because he was inept at sports. Yet a segment of the children I am asked to evaluate for their learning differences are also enduring poor large muscle coordination. Humiliating performance in sports deflates self-esteem the way a sharp nail in your driveway leads to a flat tire, especially in a kid whose report card also leaves a whole lot to be desired. It turns out that a child's proficiency in sports offers one of the most transparent views of certain brain connections. As a parent, you may note the ease or awkwardness with which your daughter runs, hops, skips, and catches or hurls a ball. As you witness these motor exploits, you are observing the circuits that link many varied neurodevelopmental functions. Watching a child swim, for example, offers insight into her ability to locate her body in space, her capacity to coordinate the activity of several limbs at once, her muscle stamina, and her motor sequencing abilities. Regrettably, because gross motor function is so visible to the outside world, many children are reluctant to practice a particular subskill like throwing or kicking a ball. Therefore, they actually end up with less practice than their peers, and so their skills never reach competency. I guess the conclusion is obvious. Parents should provide students with gross motor dysfunctions sufficient privacy during their awkward practice sessions. they must not feel exposed to the critical gazes of their peers. And we adults have to let them decide whether the practice is even worth the trouble, and then support their decision. Fine motor function. Fine motor function follows many of the same pathways as gross motor function, with a heavy dose of memory as well as eye-hand coordination. Your visual pathways and your fingers coordinate closely. A hefty load of language input, such as your daughter's art teacher's verbal directions, delivers the marching orders directing a fine motor maneuver. Some of the same students who have trouble understanding motor directions in a physical education class become confused when a ceramics or woodworking teacher issues instructions for a project. I personally have long felt that my own fingers are only attached to my upper limbs for cosmetic purposes. I willingly confess to being a fine motor klutz. As a child, I remember feeling very self-conscious about this, especially at certain points during the day. Once, while I was a student at Oxford, one of my friends at breakfast earnestly inquired, "Mel, how come you're buttering your finger and not the toast?" At that time, I was unaware of this handicap, but over the ensuing decades, it has become clear that my eyes and my fingers function totally independently of one another. That autonomy has taken its toll in the form of hundreds of stained neckties, more than my share of broken dishes and glasses, coffee stains on my desk blotter, and other assorted fine motor calamities. It is possible to become an honor student despite fine motor dysfunctions, as occurred in my case. But noticing that your classmates accomplish great things with their fingers, while your own digits strike out repeatedly, can do much to make you feel inferior. If you're the parent of such a child, you need to offer him some reassurance and then decide whether to work hard with him to blaze some sort of fine motor trail to gratification. Obviously, if your son or daughter is receiving plenty of rewards in other parts of life, fine motor success may not be all that important, and his shortcomings can be chalked up to the nobody's perfect reality. Graphomotor function and keyboarding. Graphomotor dysfunctions are one of the most common reasons a child is referred to me. Parents and teachers are often baffled by a bright kid who can't or won't write. There can be many reasons for this kind of output failure, but graphomotor dysfunction is often the cause. We might discover that your child hates to write because of feeble connections between his memory and his fingers. Motor memory guides writing as it does the moves in sports. A very heavy flow from memory takes place when your child sets out to put things down on paper. To begin with, that child needs to be able to recall letter shapes and the chain of tiny muscle movements he needs to execute them. It sounds easy, but it isn't. The Russian neuropsychologist Alexander Luria described what he called kinetic melodies, the highly precise sequences of finger muscle movements required to form letters during writing. Each letter encrypts its own unique kinetic melody, its coded sequence of muscle motions for forming that letter. Kinetic melodies, also called motor engrams, are filed in motor procedural long-term memory. Students vary in how rapidly and accurately they can recover from memory these elusive motor sequences. As one second-grade boy told me, "A lot of times when I want to make a D, my brain tells my fingers to make a B. Then I notice it later and I have to fix it." Interestingly, students who have trouble recalling the motor sequences, as well as those who have trouble visualizing the letters, seem to arrive at one very consistent conclusion. They discover and insist that they prefer printing to cursive writing. The inclination is clearly understandable, since in printing, you have only 26 discrete patterns to visualize and execute. Cursive writing, on the other hand, involves the mastery of an unending flow of lengthy visual sequences. So if and when a child insists he can print better and faster than he can do cursive, please invite him to use printing for the rest of his writing life. In observing your child during the act of writing, notice whether he keeps his eyes too close to the page. If so, he's trying to get some feedback on his letter formation, but he's doing it the hard way. The need for feedback during writing never slackens, You have to know just where your pen or pencil is at all moments while you're etching those letters. Some students harbor a condition we call finger agnosia. Believe it or not, they lose track of where their fingers are. When still quite young, they keep their eyes close to the page, watching those digits diligently, substituting visual feedback for data that should be coming from the joints and muscles of the fingers themselves. Often I find that these kids use their wrist muscles instead of their finger muscles, and since wrist muscles move so much more, the feedback may be easier for them to pick up. Regrettably, it is hard to write with your wrists. Different breakdowns in graphomotor function can dishearten your otherwise highly competent child, rendering him underproductive when it comes to homework completion, test-taking, and all written output in general. For many, the answer to this problem rests on a keyboard. Making use of a computer's word processing program, they may evolve into respectable writers despite their graphomotor dysfunction. Other forms of motor function. Earlier I mentioned oromotor and musical motor function as two important outflows. However, I will not elaborate very much on these modalities. There are indeed some kids with impediments of oromotor fluency. They may stutter or endure other speech articulation difficulties. It can be frustrating when your mouth can't keep pace with the flow of ideas, although this state may be preferable to having a mouth that's moving all the time despite a lack of ideas. Many kids with oromotor dysfunction write better than they can talk. In cases where the motor aspects of talking seriously constrain classroom participation, affected students benefit from speech therapy. As a parent, you should be exploring musical options for your kid. Much like fine motor function, highly attuned musical motor function can do much to bolster the self-esteem of children. A student's motor outlet for music might be vocal, manual, or gross motor. Gross motor musical performance includes dancing and marching. Some children are gifted when it comes to the linkage of gross motor function to music. Most of them possess a keen sense of rhythm and cadence, along with crystal clear reception of musical tones. Parents should look for and exploit those sometimes hidden capabilities. Our higher thinking system. Your child's higher thinking system activates whenever he or she meets up with information or challenges whose meanings or solutions are not immediately obvious. If his bicycle is making a mysterious screeching sound, if he's trying to understand what is meant by the term parody, if he has to write a civics report and can't conjure up a decent topic, it's time for his mind to shift into higher thinking. Five forms of higher thinking are especially germane when it comes to school performance. In different children, each of these forms of higher thinking may constitute an area of dysfunction or strength. They are, first, thinking with concepts, important when comparing socialism with capitalism. Second, problem-solving thinking, applied when figuring out how best to settle a dispute with your older sister. Third, thinking critically, mobilized when deciding whether you support drilling oil wells in Alaskan wildlife reserves. Fourth, thinking with rules, brought to bear when changing a verb to the past tense. And five, thinking creatively, in operation when composing a poem about a beaver with a fever. For some kids, the use of these, the most complex and sophisticated brain functions, makes learning a far more stimulating experience. For others, their efforts yield few dividends. How well our five forms of higher thinking operate depends a lot upon what an individual is thinking about and who that individual doing the thinking happens to be. Your son or daughter may have awesome problem-solving thinking when fixing a car, but not when settling a dispute with a classmate. Your kid may be highly creative in music, but not in writing. A student may be intuitive about human relationships, but not at all intuitive when it comes to working with computers. Such inconsistency in thinking has powerful implications for parents We should be watching both for areas in which a child reveals higher thinking, as well as for important parts of life, in school or out, in which your child's higher thinking just isn't high enough. Parents should realize that higher thinking abilities often are highly specialized. Let's look a little deeper into each of these five forms of higher thinking. We'll start with conceptual thinking. A concept is a collection of features that often go together to create an idea or category of ideas. Additionally, each concept has a name, such as the concept of furniture, the concept of capitalism, or the concept of endangered species. Concepts keep getting built upon, so if you don't grasp them too well initially, they have a way of haunting you. In the case of endangered species, the critical features might include that it is likely to be a living thing, a plant or animal, that it is diminishing in numbers, that it is in danger of becoming extinct, and that it represents a distinct, highly specific group of living things. Presumably, you have a good understanding of the concept of endangered species if you can delineate the critical features of which it is composed. It is also important to be able to offer examples or so-called conceptual prototypes. Additionally, it is helpful to think about related concepts or opposite concepts. The concept of extinction is related to endangered species, while the notion that a living thing is abundant is conceptually opposite. Identifying critical features and providing examples would help delineate any concept in science, in social studies, in mathematics, or in English class. Concepts also abound outside school. Sales tax, sales pitch, and sale item are relevant shopping concepts. Concepts make reasoning far less strenuous. They allow your child to compare big ideas, such as the difference between liberalism and conservatism. Among their other intellectually philanthropic activities, concepts reduce the strain on memory. Conceptualizing reduces memorizing by allowing you to infer things. If you know the concept of despotism, and someone tells you that a certain nation has a despotic government, you don't have to remember whether or not they hold presidential elections there. Concepts come packaged in varied formats. For example, there are abstract concepts and there are concrete concepts. A concrete concept is one that has direct appeal to one or more of the five senses. It is a concept you can touch or feel or smell or hear. Examples would be furniture, dessert, and primate. Such tangible concepts contrast with the far more abstract ones, terms such as naive, agnosticism, factoring, and abstract impressionism. As students move up in their educational careers, abstract concepts assume greater and greater importance in the curriculum. Some struggling students in high school lag behind because they remain at a very concrete level of conceptualization. Process concepts form a third packaging type. Not surprisingly, process concepts deal with processes, such as kinetic energy, internal combustion, photosynthesis, and sautéing. In each case, the critical features of the concept are the steps that take place as the process occurs. Some concepts are predominantly verbal, others nonverbal. Verbal concepts are readily taught and learned in words and sentences. Nonverbal concepts are those in which a degree of visualization is necessary to solidify understanding. Some children are highly effective when it comes to the mastery of verbal concepts, while others orient toward nonverbal conceptualization. This orientation may be a major factor in the extent to which children savor language arts classes rather than science and mathematics. In math and science, there is much greater opportunity to conceptualize without words. Of course, it is most desirable to be able to move back and forth from verbal to nonverbal conceptualization, and sometimes to form a concept both ways, by verbalizing it and also creating a mental image. As a parent, you can serve as a sensitive barometer in gauging how well your child is mastering the critical mission of thinking conceptually. If your son or daughter begins feeling disoriented or disillusioned with a body of subject matter, ask yourself, Is my kid grasping the concepts, or is he using memory at the expense of true understanding? The easiest way to find out is to look over a recently covered chapter or unit in your child's textbook or notebook. Pick out a few key concepts and have him tell you about them either orally or by drawing pictures or diagrams. It will be readily apparent if he has no sense of the features of the concepts. Parents can help children by discussing the concepts with them, assisting them to find good examples of these concepts.